Hey everybody, Jimmy Warren. Welcome to a brand new episode of Guitar Talk right here at GuitarTalkOfficial.com. We've got a great show in store for you and for everybody. Just so you know, this weekend the Greater Pittsburgh Guitar Show is taking place at the Printscape Arena in Canonsburg, Pennsylvania. That's going to be this Sunday, the 26th. That show starts at 11 and goes till 4 p.m. It costs $15 to get in. For more information, go to guitarshowusa.com. This episode is brought to you by Burt Guitars, handmade boutique guitars made in the United States in Indianapolis. And they are affordable. That's right. No $4,000 guitars here. Under $1,500 for a handmade boutique guitar. Go to BurtGuitarsUSA.com for more information. Now, my guest is well-known. Man, this guy's been around for a really long time. He is probably considered one of Canada's best guitar players. And, well, we're not going to fault him for that because we just think he's amazing regardless. And I'm talking about Colin James. Man, I had a great conversation with Colin. We had the opportunity to sit down and talk about what's been going on in his life, what's going on in his career, talk a little bit about his gear, and find out what the heck is going on with Colin James these days. So do yourself a favor, sit down, put your feet up, get a nice cool beverage, and enjoy this conversation with guitarist Colin James right here on Guitar Talk.
Hey.
Here.
Oh, Heather, could you get my in-ears? My AirPods?
Yeah.
How you
gonna
doing?
Grab my, I'm doing good. I'm going to grab my AirPods so I can hear a little better.
Okay. Really good.
Oh, I think they're, I mean, if you can hear me.
I can hear you.
You can hear me? Okay. Well, we're probably fine, Heather. Yeah.
Very good. Very good. You live in Canada, right?
I'm in Vancouver.
You're in Vancouver. Some of my favorite people are in Canada.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. My biggest show last year, believe it or not, was with Ian Thornley. That was the most viewed show I had all year.
Oh, no kidding.
And I had Steve Vai, Satriani, Timmins, Paul Gilbert, Robin Trower, and Ian Thornley was the number one show all year.
Well, isn't that exciting for Ian? Good for him. He's an old friend.
Yeah. So I'm hoping that maybe I continue this, you know, thing with Canada.
Why not?
I appreciate you doing this. I really do.
You bet.
I've been following your music and your playing for years. And, you know, I can't think of anybody better to have on Guitar Talk than Colin James.
Awesome. I appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm going to jump right out and just say I really appreciate the, when a player lists his gear on his website.
Yeah, the ever-changing gear.
Yeah.
But, we went through the list the other day. You know, it's always changing, and what you can sometimes, what you want to do and what you have to do with backline are two separate things. But
right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because you just never know, you know, you just never know. So, but you've been a guy, you know, I'm going to talk about your guitars and that for a minute, if you don't mind. You've been a guy that has really kind of ran the gamut. You know, you play Les Pauls, you play Strats, you play Dan Electros, you play National Dobros, you pretty much play it all. But when it comes right down to it, I mean, is there something that just really, you know, fits you like a glove more than anything else?
I have to say Strats, just because, you know, that was my first, 335 was my first love, to be honest. When I was 16, I had a really beautiful 1972 335. I had it for years. I had a little band called the Hoodoo Man, you know, named after the Junior Wells Buddy guy. And, that was the kind of start of my career. I opened up for George Thorogood and John Lee Hooker when I was like 16. And every picture from that era, I'm sitting with a 335. And like any other kid, when Stevie Ray Vaughan came around and I heard him on Let's Dance by Bowie and realized who he was, I had to have a Strat yesterday, you know? So I think I traded my 335 for like a purple Strats. Just so sad. It was just like a beautiful 335.
Yeah.
It was, and I got kind of tipped off on the guitar. I only got it for like $600 as a kid. So,
yeah.
But anyway, so Strats after then became kind of my thing. And, you know, especially after, you know, meeting and playing with Stevie, I was sold, you know, and Jimi Hendrix and Steve Miller, you know, all those old pictures of Steve Miller with the upside down black and white Strat from Fly Like It. I remember being a kid and just like, that's cool, you know.
Right. It doesn't even matter what it sounds like. It just looks cool.
Well, I do love the glassy out of phase treble pickup, but I love the neck pickup. You know, the neck pickup, if you want that nice warm, you know, I love it. But I had a guy tell, you know, the other day, somebody, I think it was a few years back, somebody says, you know, you got to get more Gibsons, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I finally got the Gold Top with the P90s, and that's become, I can't be without it now. So yeah. I think if I had to make a choice, it would be P90s and the Strat would be my go-to. Yeah.
I think the P90 sound is a great sound. There's a pickup out there called, it's called Zex Coils. I don't know if you ever heard of it.
No.
Guy, I don't know if he's like in New Jersey or someplace, somewhere on the East Coast. He makes these pickups, and he's got one that's a tri-bucker. And this tri-bucker is a single coil, a P90, and a PAF all in one. And there's a toggle switch. Now, of course, it's not, you know, it's not like, okay, this is like the mint, you know, single coil or the mint P90. But it's flat out amazing, you know, how good they are and how easy it is to switch between the three different tones.
Yeah.
I mean, with a toggle switch and that. Because a P90, in my opinion, that's the way to go. That's a great.
It's got that thing. Yeah. A little bit of grunge. And I do a song called Boogie Funk, you know, and that old Freddie King song. And I always have to have that guitar. But yeah, I love it a lot. I'm blessed with quite a few Strats over the years that I love. Like I'm not a collector in that I don't collect for collect's sake. You know, every guitar that I have is a working guitar. But can I show you something?
Yeah, I love it.
So years ago, I was in Montreal, Canada, opening, doing a intro for the Most Amazing Blues Gathering. It was 1991, and it was Otis Rush, Albert King, Albert Collins, Pop Staples, Teeny Hodges, Buddy Guy. And that night, they all signed this for me.
Oh, that's cool.
So if you can see, you can see, drum machine. You got Teeny Hodges here, Albert Collins, Otis Rush, Albert King, Pops, and that's Buddy. All in 1991, all signed the same day. And I've never played it. I've never taken it out. It's still got the kind of ugly black springs. And I finally changed that. I finally changed the tuning picks because it was a really ugly late 80s, you know. And I still have the late 80s bridge on it because I wanted to switch it out, but I just, something about changing it, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's definitely a guitar you don't want to, you don't want to take out. I had a cigar box guitar one time. And when I was working in television, we were doing a show around blues. And, you know, I cut my teeth in Chicago. My drummer was Kevin Johnson, who played with Buddy Guy. And so over the years, I played with, you know, with the exclusion of Albert King on your thing there. I've had the opportunity to anyway, I had this thing signed by all these guys.
Nice.
And I've had it, you know, like hanging on a wall. And then one time there was a tornado came through one of our towns. And I decided to do a benefit concert and a silent auction. And I put it in the auction. And there's a part of me that's always regretted that because, you know, some of those signatures you can't get no more.
Well, no, you know, like I've slowly over the years watched, you know, we just finished a tour with Buddy a few months ago and just had such a great time. I've known Buddy for years, but
yeah,
I hadn't seen him. And I certainly had never, I'd got up and jammed with him and played with him before, but I'd never did a whole tour. So that was really,
that's cool.
That was really fantastic. Yeah. Playing with, cool. He got me up. Sorry. Yeah.
I was going to say that's cool because, you know, he's one of the remaining legends and, you know, this is his last tour. At least he's saying it is, you know?
Yeah. It was really great. I think I first played with him in like the late 80s.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'm a Canadian artist and, you know, I'm only recently starting to get back down below the border because, you know, I was originally signed to an American record label, Virgin Records America, and, you know, had a big push when I was a kid.
Yeah.
The big multi-record deal and all that stuff. And, you know, always fighting to put blues on records with people placating you or trying to get you to do something more like the Eurythmics or more like what was going on, you know, in the day. And, you know, all these years later, here I am now at the age of 58 and we are just starting to kind of get down there more often and make an effort to kind of reestablish. And, it's been great. You know, it's like the tour with Buddy was fantastic. We played the Ryman, a place I'd never played in my life.
Oh, gorgeous,
we played ACL. ACL in Austin. And we're off on the end of this month to start a West Coast tour up from the Belly Up and then the Troubadour in LA. And this will be on my own steam. So hope some people come out.
Well, you know, I'm pretty entrenched in the guitar world and your name comes up, you know, quite often, actually, you know, you'd be surprised, nice. You know, how many
good
times, you know, it's from the guitar perspective anyway. You know, there's
right
people, you know, and
they
all live in Vancouver, I think somewhere near you.
Right. Well, I've been at it for years and years now. And, you know, these last three records I made, I didn't have the pressure of a major label. You know, I haven't been with it. Well, I was with a major not that long ago. And, you know, it's nice. I've been able to kind of take control of my own destiny a little bit and have kind of an autonomy with my record label. And that's been cool because we produced the last three on our own with me and an engineer. And he did a great job. He lives in England. So the last record we did during the pandemic, we had to do it all online. You know, it was the loneliest record I ever made, you know, because it was me and it was like you and me working together right now.
Right. Yeah. That's tough. But it was funny. I was just maybe about an hour or so ago, I was talking with Joanna Taylor Shaw.
Oh, and,
And we were touching on the subject that you just brought up, and that's the whole label independent thing. Now you find out, because you mentioned earlier that when you were with the label that, you know, they would want you to sound like the Eurythmics or something like that. You find out that you just have so much more freedom to, you know, just be Colin James and sound like Colin James and do Colin James as opposed to try to fit a mold to sell albums.
It's funny, you know, like my very first record, my very first producer was Bob Rock, you know, here in Vancouver. But I was a kid then. I was like 20 or I forget how old I was. And then I got hooked up with Tom Dowd in Miami and, you know, famous guy, famous records. But we were kind of adversarial.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't want me to play any blues. He'd done it all before. He'd done it with Clapton. He had done it with this guy and that guy and this guy and that guy. And he actually took me to a record store and said, you should be playing music like this, you know. And, you know, it wasn't the case, and it made our record, in fact, we never finished it together. I had to go on to LA and finish that record with Danny Kortchmar. And it was a shame because he had all this crazy information and you could hear stories forever. And he was a lovely guy. Tom Dowd was a smart, amazing person, but he was just a bad choice for my first producer because he would not have it.
No.
And we were just like loggerheads the whole time. And also for someone's first record, the last thing you need to do is spend like $200,000 before you even put out a song.
Right.
We got we literally got nothing. I think we got one song after 2 months. And, but then I wrote my first hit song called Voodoo Thing there or my second. And that was the only positive I can think. And by the time my first record came out, I had seven producers. I had Tom Dowd, Neil Dorfman from Dire Straits, Bob Rock, Danny Kortchmar, there's some others. So it was really an uneven start, you know. Yeah. And then my second record in Ardent Studios in Memphis, we used Joe Hardy. And that was like a blessing for me because Joe was artist friendly. He grew up on Stax. We were in Memphis, so that was awesome. And so that was, I was glad I got saved by on my sophomore record, I got saved by a sympathetic mind.
Yeah. You know?
And he died a few years ago. He ended up working all Billy Gibbons records, and Joe was kind of a genius computer guy. And, you know, but around the time after my second record, you know, that's when my first little big band record came around in the early 90s. And I think, you know, you remember how kind of blues rock hit a bit of a wall in the early 90s? Like, all of a sudden everyone was listening to Pearl Jam and everything shifted so radically that we were going to put out another record, just like the ones I'd already made, or at least in that pattern. And we just realized that anything we put out right now is going to be ignored because there was kind of nothing going on. So that's where the little big band idea, why don't we just go do a bunch of late 40s, early 50s swing music. And that was met with absolute trepidation by the record company. I mean, actually shock and horror. You know, I flew down to LA and told them what I wanted to do. This is pre-Brian Setzer, you know, there was no precedent really. Yeah. I mean, apart from Robert Plant doing the Honey Drippers. You know. So and then we put the record out and just got lambasted in the press up in Canada. And why is he doing this? And then all of a sudden it became kind of popular in a certain set of people and ended up being one of my highest selling records ever, you know, in Canada. So that was great. And I got to meet Room Full of Blues. And we did the whole record in 2 weeks, start to finish, all live, no charts, you know, because playing with the Room Full of Blues was like playing with the Chieftains. You know, they'd been together all their lives.
Right.
At that point. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I remember waking up the day I was supposed to go meet them all down at Little Mountain here in Vancouver. And I was so nervous, you know, I'd never met any of them before. I think I talked to Greg Piccolo on the phone just a little bit. And Chris Kimsey, the producer from England, who did Tattoo You with, you know, the Stones, was going to be there. And I just remember not wanting to leave home. I was so scared to go to the studio. And then I got there and it was easy as pie. I mean, those guys were great.
But now, you know, later on down the road, you're not on a major label now. You're pretty much doing things yourself, correct?
I'm on a label called True North. And Stony Plain.
Stony Plain. Yeah.
Yeah. But they're different in the way that it's a more even relationship, you know, they know what they're in for with me. It's not like they're trying to get me to be something else, you know?
Right.
So I'm kind of left alone to figure out what to do.
Well, they're basically like a blues label as it is. So, you know, I would think you would fit right in really well, you know?
Yeah. They've been great. You know, and I have a history of some, you know, more pop and rock history in Canada in particular. So, you know, it's been a long, varied, varied road. Yeah.
So let's go back to, you know, let's go to the early days for you, if you don't mind. And then I really like to know, you know, because you really are a great player. And so I wonder, what are some of the things that you did, you know, when you were in that process of developing, becoming Colin James, if you will. And that, what are some of the things that you did that made you the player that you are right now?
Well, I made the decision to be a player early. I left home when I was 16. I left school. I moved to another city. Tried to go back to school, but it didn't work. it was a free school, and I wasn't going to do my homework at that point. I was ready to play, you know. I think opening up for Thorogood for three shows when I was 16, and the John Lee Hooker thing happened that year as well. And I just, you know, I never questioned whether that was what I was going to do, and kind of blind faith, played on street corners,
yeah,
played in front of liquor boy stores, you know, played for change in Winnipeg, played for change in Montreal on the subways, lived in Montreal for a year and a half when I probably shouldn't have been, but I met some people there. Used to be cool blues clubs in Montreal. I saw Charles Brown in Montreal a number of times. James Cotton I saw in Montreal a number of times too.
Yeah.
But, you know, just kept moving, you know. Really, I just kept playing and moving. No matter what the situation was, I'd move from town to town. If I got stagnant, I'd move. I kind of lived out of a garbage bag for a number of years. Just be ready to do it, you know. And early on, I got a job acting, if you can believe it, in a play. And I was so broke at the time. They were going to offer me $700 a week to be in a play. So I did theater for like 6 months, of all things. And then a harmonica player from San Francisco named David Bergen had moved to Vancouver. And he was like Norton Buffalo. Really, really good. He used to play with Amos Garrett.
Oh, okay.
A fair amount. Amos Garrett's a hero of mine. I love Amos. Yeah. He's Canadian and all that work with the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. And,
right.
And he was really nice to me when I was a kid, Amos, too. And, what was I saying? What was I talking about? So I moved to Vancouver here just to get the job with David Bergen.
Right.
Like, I knew that his guitar player was from somewhere else and wasn't willing to travel that much. So I moved here going, I'm going to get his job.
Yeah.
I'm going to get that guy's job. And I got it. And I ended up playing with David for a couple of years. Then I played with Billy Cowsill from the Cowsills. He's dead now, but Billy was awesome. Billy could sing like John Lennon or Elvis Presley or like When Smoke Gets You in Your Eyes. Billy was really an awesome guy. And I did about 2 years with Billy. I think we opened up for Katie Lang in 1984. We opened up for Katie Lang, if you can believe it. And David got me the first gig with another. I played with Dr. John when I was like 18 at the Edmonton Folk Festival. I got to be his guitar player just for a day.
Yeah.
And that was exciting. So really, I was just kept going through hell or high water. And, you know, through a lot of that, there was cockroach infested apartments. And the whole nine yards. But finally, you know, Stevie was the break, you know. I was out here and I was kind of depressed. I was broke and I went home to my home province in the middle of Canada, Saskatchewan. And I wanted to spend a week at home just to kind of ease up a bit. And then I got a call saying, could you be at a place tomorrow to open up for Stevie Ray Vaughan, you know? And I said, well, let me call some people because I've been out of town for 3 years. I have no idea who's around. So everyone I phoned couldn't do it. And they had all moved out of town. So I phoned my friend in Saskatoon and I said, any ideas what I should do? He says, call the Saskatoon Jazz Society. So I phoned the Saskatoon Jazz Society and two guys who played jazz, little Kit, quite a lot older than me, showed up at 5 o'clock in the parking lot of the venue. And we went into this little rehearsal room and we were just trying to get some shuffles, you know, get a half an hour, 35 minutes worth of material because Stevie had fired his opening act the night before.
Wow.
And Stevie came busting in the room within 10 minutes and he said, is it true what I heard? And I said, I don't know what you heard. He says, you guys all just met each other? And I said, I'm afraid it is. You know? And he thought it was hilarious and kind of went off. And we just had the best night ever. He got me up for the encore. And the next night was my hometown. So he took me to the next town. And we opened up, with the same band of people I had just met the night before. And that started off me and Stevie's. And that's when kind of things started moving.
Yeah. But as a player, though, right? As a guitar player, what are some of the things that you did as a guitar player? You know, from, I don't know, in in order to be the player that you are now. Your history is fascinating, and I definitely loved all the times when you're broken and there's cockroaches, because you know what, that says a lot about you and a lot about your character as a player, because you know there's a lot of people that wouldn't go through that aren't that passionate or that devoted or whatever in order into making it, you know. And that says a lot about you. And I admire when people do that. You know, I think that's, you know, when I see them guys on the streets in Chicago and the subways and that, and they're playing and stuff like that, I pay attention to them. And that, because you never know, you know, you might see that guy 3 years later somewhere else doing something.
If he's out there doing it, he's made a decision and that's what he's going to do. Exactly. And that's pretty cool. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But as a player, though, when it comes to picking up the guitar and playing.
I played guitar first, but at the age of 13, I started playing mandolin, a lot of mandolin. And I think it really helped me as a flat picker. For a while, I played nothing but bluegrass and Irish music. And I think between 13 and 16, I probably did the majority of my learning on a guitar as well. But for a while, I left the guitar behind. For a while, I thought I was going to be an Irish traditional musician, if you could even believe it. I was so into it. And I finally, at one point, it dawned on me, how are you going to sell yourself as a middle of Canada? You might ask, how could you sell yourself as a blues player? But I think at one point, I just realized it wasn't going to be my fate. And I saw James Cotton when I was 16 play a massive festival in it. Rocked my world, you know, but really I wasn't a woodshedder. Like, I'm not someone who has tended to go into a room and do scales. I've always been interested, and I've always tried to keep what I listen to varied. You know, I did the majority of my blues listening, I think, in my 20s. And although I still listen to a wide range of material, I like to try to keep the doors open and listen to singer songwriter stuff and Radiohead. And so I think it's important to keep your vision, your head on a swivel, because there's lots of stuff you can learn from others, even if it's not your genre.
Right.
You can hear glimmers of sometimes, you know, how you hear a song from a distance and you go, that'd be a cool song. And then you go closer to the song. It's not what you thought it was.
Yeah.
It's a great way to write music when you hear things from a distance and you go, that would be cool. And you get there and you go, it's not as cool as I thought. Do what was cool, you know. But I think really at the end of the day, it was trial by fire, you know. Yeah. I mean, it was live. We did years and years of crisscrossing the country over and over and over. And back then, you could play in a venue for a week at a time. And that just doesn't happen anymore, you know.
Yeah.
You got one slot, you got the early slot or the late slot, and you're in, you're out. And back then, you could really, the first time I ever played Toronto, I played a famous place called the Horseshoe Tavern. And, you know, now if you play the Horseshoe, you're going to get a set. That's it. Back then, you got there on a Monday and you played till Saturday.
Yeah.
And when no people showed up on Monday, Tuesday, it was okay, because by Wednesday, the people started coming in. So, you know, I look at some young players today and I just wonder how they're going to cut their teeth, because where do you go? You know, it's just the finances with the Spotify and it's just a tough time, you know?
Yeah. I mean, young players today, it's extremely difficult, you know, to get out there because, not only that, you mentioned Spotify. And that just brings up the whole conversation of there's so much competition, right? I mean, you got the big guys, and even with the competition going on, sometimes you don't even know when they're releasing an album. You don't know when they're going on tour. You know what I mean? Unless something comes across your desk or across your social media or something like that. It used to be, when the Stones were going on tour or when anybody was going on tour, you knew it.
You knew
what was going on. Or if they were releasing an album. And now, because, you know, anybody with a laptop can make a record and put it on Spotify, well, now you have all this noise. Does that seem right? Or am I being fair, or is that unfair?
Well, it's really hard. I mean, you know, like I say, I'm just starting to get a little more known south of the border.
Yeah.
And it is hard. There's a million players. It's a massive country. I'm kind of a newbie at the age of 58. I have to be kind of a newbie now. you know, but that's good for you too, because I'd rather expand my field and have know in the future I can go play new places than hit the same territory over and over again. So this is a commitment we've made. It's hard because you don't, you kind of got to start from, you got to put your pride in your pocket.
Right, right.
And, you know, it's, we just finished it, you know, we did the tour with Buddy and then we went back down and did our own little run through the East last year. We played a few of the same places. I loved it. You know, we played Chicago with the City Winery there and yeah. Ronnie Baker came out to say hi. It was great to see Ronnie. And I felt so happy to be in Chicago. What a city, man. I've been there a few times, but last time I had a couple of days off just to kind of walk around and really enjoy Chicago. And boy, I ended up reading a book about the start of Chicago with Wolf Point.
Oh yeah.
And all that history. You know?
Yeah. Well, you might not want to walk around today. It's a little bit different today, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. We kept our, you know, I just walked around the Miracle Mile. I didn't get, you know, I mean, yeah. But such a great history. Chicago is so interesting.
Well, there's been, I mean, you want to talk about blues. I mean, I can remember because when I started touring and started playing was in 88. And back then, you know, I was playing the Checkerboard and, you know, the Old Buddy Guys and Kingston Mines and Wise Fools Pub. And, you know, there was so many. Coco Taylor had a place. And
what was your place called?
Huh?
What was Coco's place called?
It was under her name.
Oh, it was?
Yeah, she had a place on the west side. And then they ended up opening another one down on Orange Street downtown called Coco Taylor's, which was just her name. You know, it's kind of like B.B. King's. It's just the same kind of thing, you know.
I love Coco Taylor. I covered one of Coco's on this last record. It's actually a Magic Sam song.
Yeah.
That's why I'm crying.
Yeah, what a beautiful, great song.
Her voice, man. Great song. The recording of hers on that song is really funny, though, because she sings it amazing. But you ever heard the Chess version of that? Is it Alligator? It might be Alligator. Somebody came in with their guitar. It's like they didn't even, like, if you listen to her version of That's Why I'm Crying, whoever's playing guitar, for the first half, they're really subtle. And at the end, it just starts getting really scratchy and weird. And it's like they had a bad connection or something. It's just amazing that it made it on a record. It's funny.
Yeah, it's possible it could have been a bad connection. But you know, the city back then, I mean, it was amazing. And the blues culture too back then was amazing.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that I think is missing today in music, because I can recall, I don't know if you'd ever heard of him. There was a guy named Buddy Scott. He had a band called Buddy Scott and the Rib Tips.
Okay.
Right. And his mom played guitar with Elmore James at one point in time. Wow. Yeah. His son was Tyrone Davis's musical director in that. And so it was a musical family, but people like that would take guys like me, anybody that was eager to learn, anybody that was wanting to be a part of the community. And it was like, it was almost like you were part of their family. You know, they'd invite you everywhere, have you everywhere. I mean, I got invited to Tyrone Davis's birthday party at Lee's Unleaded Blues. And when I went in there, Coco Taylor was there. It was just like all these people, Lonnie Brooks, all these people were there that I didn't know at the time. But they were all so welcoming. And now today, you don't find that same kind of atmosphere.
Right.
Where it's inviting in that.
Right.
Oh, it's like
more of a community, you mean?
Yeah. It's like, okay, a young guy shows up and he sits in, or you're hosting a jam or something like that. And you go, you see the guy's eager. And so you start doing what you can to invite him around and help him out and stuff like that. Yeah. You don't see that happen too much.
Yeah. I was sure. I mean, I was helped by a lot of people, you know, I mean, in that way, you know, I mean, when I first moved out here into Vancouver, I didn't know anybody. And there was a band called the Powder Blues from up here. And there was a Jim Burns, who was a local St. Louis originally, but he's a local blues guy. And those guys would get me up and they would help me out. And, you know, without them, you know, it means a lot. Yeah, well, live music's had a hard time. I mean, it's been pretty crazy. I'd be so happy to get back on the road, you know. And it's like that Buddy tour was the first thing we had done in 2 years, and it really got me back in shape. Because what nothing you don't realize as a player is that how much of your health, not just mental health, but your physical health comes from standing on stage with guitar for 2 hours a night or whatever it is. And after 2 years of sitting around, man, I'd go and do an hour and a half show and like my guitars felt so heavy. And I found that now I'm kind of back from playing again and it feels great because it really, apparently, you know, you can only imagine how it'd be for someone like, well, like Buddy, you know, after 2 years of that, you know, who needs that? You know, so thank God we're at least we're getting back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you got to take care of yourself in order to tour, you know, it's just, I mean, when you're young, I mean, it doesn't matter, but when you start to get, you know, you start to get in your 40s and into your 50s and going up, you know, it's not the same as it was. And you got to really, because it's hard work. People don't realize how hard it is.
Well, it is. And it, you know, and the older you get, the heavier those guitars get. I mean, I love Les Pauls, but I'll say no to a Les, I won't play a Les Paul custom, you know.
Yeah.
So heavy.
Yeah.
I've got one that stays at home now, you know.
And you got to get one of Frank Marino's SGs because they only weigh 4 pounds, four and a half.
SGs are ridiculous. But I've never got along with an SG.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't like it.
They're so light and I can't. Yeah.
His are lighter than a normal one because a normal one, like 6 pounds or something like that. And he has his custom made to where they're only like 4 or 4.5 pounds. The body's even a little bit smaller than the regular. But I'm just saying that that's what you go to.
Yeah. What I do love about an SG is all that real estate up on the high end, though.
Yeah.
You get a football field at the top there. It's like, whoa.
Yeah.
But I just never, I think the weirdest guitar I ever had a bit of a fling with was it a Firebird. I had a bit of a Firebird way years ago. But now, yeah. I mean, for slide, I use all silver tones. And love my old Dan Electros, you know.
I noticed that you played a lot of those over the years.
Yeah. Well, I just find for slide, you know, they're not the best intonation, but now they're all starting to make them with the adjustable bridges. So that's gotten better too.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, I see someone like Bonnie and some of the great slide players who play with a Strat and I'm just, it's Ry Cooter, but I've just never been able to make it happen. And when Bonnie's a friend, you know, I'm always trying to look at the guitar to check the action and see how I'll have to ask Hutch, your bass player to help me get the riddle of Bonnie's action and height and string gauge. But I've just never been able to make a Strat sound good with the slide. And I find silver tones, you can just reef that action up high and, you know.
Yeah.
Love them.
Yeah. So do you have plans to make a new album anytime soon? Or
I do. I mean, right now we've got a fair amount of stuff on the books right now. I got the pandemic really, I mean, I keep a notebook all the time. So if someone said, you have to make a record tomorrow, you know, I've got a list of every song that piqued my interest over the, you know, I keep lists of everything. And, but as far as original music right now, I gotta crack the whip. Sorry.
No, you're good.
Decline. Sorry about that. you know, and I find the pandemic really interrupted my process because in the past, I find I don't really write with strangers anymore. I used to do that when I was a kid, and I found it really anxiety ridden. I like to write with people I've written and had success with before. A lot of them don't live here. They live in Nashville or they live in the other part of Canada. So I'm going to try to get a session together soon with one of my main writing partners. And we've written 30 songs together over the years. So I feel a bit like I'm in my little studio B here and I gotta crack the whip. I'm just about ready to hit the road for about a month coming up. So I really won't be able to do it for a bit, but it'll be great to get back out there and try to leave this ghastly rain behind up here in Vancouver and get down to California where where it'll be nicer.
Yeah, well, but they've had some pretty serious rain and flooding in California from
they north, sure have. North, yeah, I'm hoping that won't be the case. Yeah. We're just in an atmospheric river here today. It's just
nasty.
I love Vancouver because we get very little snow, and it's you know, I can ride my bike all year long, but I don't like January, February. It's just like
yeah.
But the rest of it's beautiful.
Yeah, I saw on your website that you're going to be in California. I think your first gig's what, the 26th?
At the Belly Up, yeah.
Yeah, at the Belly Up.
Yeah, San Diego.
Yeah.
And then the Troubadour in San Francisco, we're playing the Great American Music Hall. And I hope, I haven't played San Francisco since I played Slims, in 1990.
Oh, my Lord.
So, yeah. So I hope some people show up.
Oh, wow. I thought maybe you had played Biscuits and Blues over the years there or something.
No, although I met the guy who ran that place.
Yeah.
At the airport after the blues cruise the other day, I met him at the airport. He was in the lounge. I was sitting there with, who was I with? The blues player from San Francisco. Oh, God, I can't remember. Anyway, I just met that guy. But we're playing that place in... we're playing another place called Biscuits and Blues somewhere in April on the East Coast.
Really?
I can't remember where it is, Florida? Or?
Yeah. There's the Funky Biscuit.
That's where we're playing.
Yeah, that's in Boca Raton, I think.
Yeah, we're playing
there. That's a great place. Both of those were great places. It was a sad thing when Biscuits and Blues had to close down. That guy's connected. Next time you have a conversation with him, he's connected.
Okay. Do you ever go to Tobacco Road in the middle of Florida? Do you remember a club called Tobacco Road?
No.
I saw Albert King there years ago, and I wondered if it was still a thing. Probably not.
I haven't heard that name.
That night I saw Albert King, he was super grumpy, and he made the whole band tune to him. His horns. He made his horns tune
yeah,
to him.
Yeah, yeah.
It was such a disaster that everything was out from that point on. It was a funny night. And I remember him telling the front of house guy to turn off the PA. Turn it off. So they turned off the whole PA.
Yeah.
And kept playing. Yeah, it was crazy.
I saw Buddy do that once at his club. He came out and he was out of tune really bad. Yeah, and I think he took 10 minutes at least. You know, messing around with his guitar, trying to get it. Finally, he just handed it off to somebody.
Oh, God. Those are awful moments.
Those are fun moments, though, if you're not the player, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know what, man? I'm glad we got an opportunity to talk and I get to learn more about you and expose you to, you know, to my audience and that. I put out these polls a couple of times a year, you know, just asking people, who would you like to see? And your name's come up several times. And
oh, fantastic.
Yeah. And so, I can attest that back in the days when you were doing the big band thing, that's when I first heard of you, you know, first got familiar with you and that. And so, you know, I've kind of followed you on and off ever since then. And I wish you the best of success in California, and hopefully you can get a new album out and come to Chicago.
Yeah, I hope to have something out by, you know, it won't take too long once I get the ball rolling, but I got to get it rolling.
Yeah. Well, I wish you all the success, though, Colin. I really do.
All right. Thanks so much.
For this time, man. I appreciate it.
Pleasure's mine. Have a great – thanks for having me.
Oh, you bet, man. Take care. Okay. Bye.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Colin James. I want to thank him so much for participating in this episode. Do yourself a favor, like, follow, and share him wherever he is. Go and see him in concert. Make sure you're supporting his music. And he's a great talent. Thank you so much, Colin, for being on the show. Until next week, I'm Jimmy Warren. Thank you so much for tuning in to Guitar Talk. If you want to know more, go to guitartalkofficial.com. Until next week, I'm Jimmy Warren. See you around.